Well, hello there, it's Antrice, and welcome to another episode of the Savvy Painter Podcast.
This episode of the Savvy Painter Podcast is sponsored by Picture Salon. Picture Salon is a fine art print company specializing in digital capture and reproduction of original works. They use high-quality archival pigmented inks that resist fading for over 70 years. And Picture Salon is giving Savvy Painter listeners 20% off of first-time orders. All you have to do is go to picturesalon.com and use the code SAVVY20 at checkout. That's picturesalon.com. Use the code SAVVY20 and you will get 20% off your first order.
My guest this week on the Savvy Painter Podcast is Andy Miller, perhaps better known to you as Andy J. Pizza from the Creative Pep Talk Podcast. Or you might remember him from the episode I did a few weeks ago where I rounded up a few other podcasters to talk about what we've all learned from our experiences talking to so many other artists. So Andy J. Pizza is back with me today. Andy, as I said, is the founder and host of the Creative Pep Talk Podcast. And he is here to talk to you about a wide range of issues. We start off this episode talking about some of the challenges that he experienced growing up, how he learned to reframe them and use much of it to his creative advantage. We also go on to discuss copyright issues. This is a really interesting conversation. We talk about when the law serves artists and how it can also harm creativity. I get a lot of questions from artists about how to choose what to focus on. Well, Andy believes that early in your career, you should say yes to as many opportunities as you can, but eventually there is a tipping point and the appearance of opportunities flips. And that's when you should start saying no to almost everything. So we have a great discussion about that towards the end of the podcast. I had a blast talking with Andy, and I think you'll really enjoy this conversation. So here is Andy J. Pizza. Andy, welcome back to the Savvy Painter Podcast. So excited to have you here. Thanks for taking the time.
I am so pumped to be here. I am ready to talk all things creativity, art, what have you. I'm pumped.
Let's do it. For the one or two people out there who don't know who you are, tell me about Andy J. Pizza.
Well, I know for a fact there are just millions and millions of people that don't know who I am because it's like a challenge over the next 40 years of my life with my creative stuff. But for plenty of you people don't know who I am. I'm an illustrator for the likes of the New York Times, Washington Post, Nickelodeon, bunch of clients. But I also have this podcast called Creative Pep Talk, where I help people thrive in their creative careers. And I'm also super into giving talks. So that's a big part of what I do. So I go travel the country, pepping people up with my creative pep talks.
Nice. I love it. So we were both just discovering in our little chat that we've been doing this about the same amount of time. And I'm just like, I'm so fascinated about that. But tell me, what made you decide to start your podcast in the first place?
I have a big answer to that question, because helping creative people is kind of my, as cheesy as it might sound, I take it very seriously as my purpose in life. And it's deeply personal to me, because I grew up, before I go into the story, I'll just say I'm a huge believer in this idea of leaning into our neurodiversity, which is like a word that I hear around. It's kind of, you know, picking up steam, and it makes me get teary-eyed when I say it because it means so much to me. And it's this idea of like, yeah, we're talking about people with autism and ADHD and dyslexia and dyspraxia and blah, 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 all that stuff. But to me, leaning into neurodiversity is less about the disorders or whatever, what have you. And to me, it's about leaning into how different our brains are. Every person's brain is dramatically different to the rest of them. And I think we went through this season of time with the Industrial Revolution in the past 100, 200 years, where we created this system that was saying, what's the most average thing about people? Because they were looking for human cogs, interchangeable parts within a factory. They would look at people. This is a Seth Godin thing, but I've kind of elaborated and I think about it all the time. What's the most average thing about humans, and how do we exploit that to the max degree? Meaning, what's the most common features of a brain so that we can predict it, so it's an interchangeable part? And then how do we train that so that we get the most fabricate the most samest type of human over and over and over, because that's kind of what we need, right?
And yes, stay in the box, stay in your seat, like don't get out of your lane. And, you know, like from school age on, the whole education system is completely designed for that, to get people to respond to a certain thing in a certain way, exactly the same way, so that they can go out and sit presumably behind a desk or in a factory and work.
Yeah, 100%. And be like interchangeable parts. Be like, this human, you can put this human in, that human in, whichever human you put in, they're basically the same, because we've trained them to be the same. So we've given the same skills, and, you know, we've maximized the sameness of humanity. And I think for me, that's kind of the world's, whether it's climate change or, you know, economies or what, all these different issues that you see in the world. I feel like that's like the world's cancer of, like, in the same way that a body cells start to replicate unnaturally, metastasize the same cells over and over and over unnaturally. We have that thing happening in the world where the same types of humans are being churned out and churned out and churned out until it's metastasizing to where it's now, I feel like, you know, humanity is almost like a cancer on the planet because of this.
Yeah,
oh, I know it sounds really extreme, but this idea, like, really gets me kind of excited. And I think about how, but the beautiful thing about people, and the thing that is, whether it's evolution or divine design, in our molecular makeup, we are literally completely a unique code, every single one. There is no possibility that DNA pattern can replicate itself. Like, that's a fact. And so we have this diversity within our DNA, within our brain. This is the gold mine. This is the balance that I think needs to be restored by leaning into not how we're the same, but how we're different. So that's kind of the big idea, but where it comes from is very personal to me, because I have ADHD. My mom has ADHD. It's undiagnosed, but I know where it comes from. And my mom, growing up, when I was really little, everyone would tell me that I was just like my mom. And I was like, that's the best news that I've ever heard, because she's a weirdo and she's making stuff all the time. I just think she's the coolest person in the world. She's super loud and weird. And I was like, man, every time my aunts and uncles would be like, you're just like your mom, I'd be like, yes, keep telling me that stuff. But then as I grew up, I watched her. She tried to fit in. She tried to repress her weirdness and just, you know, have regular jobs and be a stay-at-home mom and just do these things that, you know, lots of people find easy to do. And it was through that, like, repression of herself and the opposite of leaning into her neurodiversity that just caused these extreme explosions in her personal life. So she, from an early age, she left me and my brother, started a new family, had more kids, couldn't stay in that role, left them for somebody else, ended up getting into really hardcore drug addiction, ended up getting a brain tumor, just kind of like wrecked her life trying to be somebody that she wasn't, trying to show up on the tests in school and be a kind of a normal middle American. And I think by the time I was 18, it was a blessing and a curse, because watching her come out of the hospital from this tumor and have this drug addiction and all this, you know, she had this physically abusive boyfriend, just a freaking mess. Her life had just totally turned to by the time I was 18. And I'm looking at her and I remember those words from childhood just kind of like became this prophetic vision of my future of doom, which is,
I'm just like her.
This is you. Like, this is what the world does to people like you. And I think the blessing and the curse of it was, from that moment on, I knew, I don't know how I'm going to exist, or I don't know how I'm going to succeed or thrive, but I know it's not going to be in a normal way. So people would be like, well, what job are you going to get after college? And I'd be like, I'm not going to. I'm not going to get a job. I'm not going to go, just like, I know if I try to walk that route that I'm going to fail supremely. And so from that kind of freed me up from an early age to just be like, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I know it's not going to be normal, because if I try to do that, I can try for 40 years and it's just going to be disaster after disaster. So, and then as I started to find a little success in illustration, as soon as I got my first big job, I did a job for Sony, their PSP, right out of college. And it was a really great job and I was super pumped about it. And everything that I'd learned that got me to that breakthrough. I was instantly calling my friends and be like, are you doing this? Are you doing that? You should be doing this. I instantly wanted to turn around and tell everybody what I was doing.
And lift everybody else up. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I ended up getting into a bunch more hard crap right after that. That meant that I had to learn a lot bigger lessons, deeper lessons, business lessons, all kinds of stuff. But it was that kind of crucible of the first 4 or 5 years out of my school and the things with my mom that ended up just lighting this ridiculous passion. And I've said this before too, this idea that like this kind of digging out of your heart, which when I'm a kid and I'm going through all the pain of missing my mom and, you know, watching her just destroy herself and all this stuff. And also watching my friends who are creative people that are brilliant, struggle with suicide, drug addiction, graduating from high school and then just doing nothing, not finding any way to do anything with their life. And I'm dealing with all the pain of creative people just having such a hard time that I'm feeling like there's these chunks of my heart that are just being dug out and it's just super painful. And I think later I realized that hole dug in my heart is actually a well of passion. That's where all of that passion comes from. That's why I started my podcast. It was after, so like I said, I was writing blogs and I was always doing something all through my journey of becoming an illustrator. But by the time I launched that podcast, I had built a decent life on the back of my illustration. You know, I bought a house on the back of my illustration and we had a good thing going and I had a lot of good clients and everything. And so I was pretty established as an illustrator before I ever started podcasting, but that's kind of how it happened.
I love it. It's a great story. Interesting. There are just so many parallels. And there's a couple things I'm thinking about right now. One is I had this friend of mine when I was in my mid-20s who was diagnosed with cancer and he survived it, thank God. But during that time, I also worked with him. And so it wasn't really known at Disney where we were working what was going on. And we kind of talked about that a lot. And one thing that I learned from that whole experience that has stuck with me is that you never know the whole story behind people. You never know what they're going through. Like people can look on the outside like they have it all together and, or that they've never experienced any pain or that they've never experienced anything out of the ordinary, outside of the cog of what we like to believe our lives are supposed to be. And yet, all of us have. And that experience for me was a pretty profound one. And then, you know, a very similar thing, like I know I've never talked about this on the podcast. I've vaguely referenced it, but I've never like actually come out and said it. But my brother died of a heroin overdose. And that was an enormously, it was obviously extremely painful. But what I took out of that lesson, what I took out of his death was a couple of things. And the one that relates to this is just this idea that our lives are really precious and very short. And a lot of the reasons that, you know, like he got into that lifestyle was in that addiction was, you know, first of all, it's in our family, but second, this idea of trying to be somebody that you're not and that facade, that mask that we put on is not sustainable and it's going to come out somehow, some way. And from that, I just got this determination that I'm going to, number one, I don't know how long I'm going to be here. We have no guarantees, you know, none of us do. So it just became sort of my mission to stop, to empower people and to kind of look at fear in the face for what it is. And the things that we're afraid of, and I'm thinking right now of the stuff that happens in our studio, the creativity, all of that stuff is in our heads. And it is so, I don't know how to describe it, but it's just
small
so
stakes, really.
Small. And it's so terrifying to me that people will live their lives guided by that fear when they have so much more inside of them. And that's what I hope to do with my podcast and with these conversations that we're having right now is to empower people and inspire people to just kick the box a little bit. Like you may not be ready to make this gigantic leap, but you can poke that, you know, you can look at that boogeyman in the face and be like, okay, I at least see you. I see who you are. I'm still scared of you, but I see you. And every day, just a little bit, push it a little bit more until your boundaries are expanded.
Yeah, I completely agree. I honestly think, you know, with the ADHD thing, the thing that drives me from an early age, even, I don't think ADHD is very well known, like what the real story is with people that have this thing is. Yeah, I don't think people really know. And it's all a bunch of things that when you tell people, they're like, but one of the things that is a biggest driver is being anti-boredom. So like, boredom to me is like physical pain. It's really true. Like, I'm so driven by not being bored that, you know, that's a huge problem with people with ADD keeping a job, is that if it's not interesting, meaningful, exciting to them, it's very hard for them to show up and do it because their executive function in their brain doesn't work that well. The part of their brain that's the dad or mom or whoever, the grown up in there, is saying pretty much never wins the argument. So that's the thing. Like, they're like, you're going to work. And then the baby in your brain is like, nope, I'm not. I'm going to stay, draw pictures. And so for me, I think when I was little, the thing that always happened to me was that I never had the option to be complacent or settle in a comfort zone. But I see those people that don't have that urgency. They're not realizing how short of a life we have and how little is guaranteed. And I look at those people that are living half their life. They're not really living into, they're letting those fears control them. And that's kind of a big thing for me, a big question of, it'd be great if we didn't need tragedy to spark the urgency. I'm reading this biography with Jim Henson. He's probably my biggest inspiration. And he had the same thing early on in his career. He was doing like puppet show stuff for local access TV kind of things early on. And he was always like really smart and driven. But while he was young, his older brother, who was also really young, I think early 20s, had a tragic accident and died, and it just lit him on fire. And ever since then, he was just like a man burning alive, making stuff, like always had that sense of like, we've got to be doing the next thing. We got to, you know, just very, and everyone says from the before and after of that time for him was so different. And he had such an incredible sense of urgency after that. And you can see it as you're reading through the book, just the amount of things, all the plates that he's spinning and all that. He's very aware of the shot clock. And I know there's an anxiety and there's another side to that that can be not helpful. But I do think this thing of, like I've heard Ray Romano say, like, you're going to die. So he'll think about all the time, you're going to die. So is this fear, like, is this something you need to play at in light of the fact that you're going to be dead at any time? And it's kind of a morbid way of thinking about it, but it's that memento mori thing too. It's just.
Exactly. There is a sense of urgency to our lives for that reason, or a sense of, you know, the whole idea behind memento mori, I'm pronouncing mora. Okay. The memento mori is that it's not to be morbid and to become a hypochondriac or to be afraid to leave your house because something might happen. It's more like you have this one beautiful life. This is it. How do you want to spend it? What do you want to do with it? Do you want to glue yourself to whatever news network you watch is and become obsessed with whatever's happening in Washington, D.C. or whatever the capital of your country is? Or do you want to participate in life and become the person that you're brought here to be, which is ever changing? And it's such a profound gift that we have that it's like that idea, the memento mori is super inspiring to me, because it's like, yeah, let's do this. Like, we're here. What can we all, we're here right now together. Let's do this. What are we going to do?
It should be, the point is to be afraid of staying in your house, be afraid of hiding under your sheets, because be afraid that that's how you could have spent your life. It's the opposite of that. I totally feel you on that. And I think that sense of urgency and that in the high stakes of watching my mom and wanting to knowing that I wanted to be a good dad. I was very inspired by my dad. He's a great person who has worked hard his whole life. And he went from working class poverty, really, like in his family, and worked super hard to get really far in the business world. And I knew that I wouldn't be like him, but I do think I'm very lucky and privileged to have that example, because it inspired me to the power of figuring out your thing and doing it. So totally relate to that.
Yeah. And I think, you know, what's super interesting about that concept is just that idea that I learned from my friend that, you know, you just never know what people have been through. And that allows just that idea And there's a lot of power in that, because you, when you start thinking that way, it's empowering to yourself. And it's also allows you to be like very, very empathetic with other people, because you don't know what they're going through. You have no idea. The guy who cut you off in traffic could have just found out, you know, something, you know, life-changing, or, you know, like there's so many possibilities other than he doesn't like you and he did that on purpose.
Or he's a bad person or whatever.
Yeah, or he's a bad person or whatever. And that same grace can happen, you know, you can apply that to yourself that, yeah, we all have a lot of stuff going on, and sometimes you're going to make mistakes, and sometimes you're not going to get in the studio, and sometimes you're not going to do a great, make a great piece of art that day, but you show up every day anyway. And that's, those moments are the beautiful pieces of your life. We're going through this back and forth.
Hey, whatever. I like I told you, we started with, I have ADHD. Tangents are my domain. So feel free. You want to talk about, I don't know, Roger Rabbit right now? That movie was weird.
That was a weird movie. And what was the other one that had like Brad Pitt in it? There was another one that came out about that same time. See, I can go with you on this.
Yeah, I can't remember what it is. I'm telling you, I can do it. You came back to me with the same interest and urgency about Roger Rabbit. Now we're actually down that rabbit hole.
See how that works.
Yeah,
but let's talk about what happens in the studio. Let's go down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, sure. That's probably slightly more of a normal tangent to go on from there.
I love this idea. This is something I've also been thinking about a lot. You know, that concept of how we're sort of trained to be cogs in the wheel, and how it's very convenient to want to plot human behavior along a graph. And when there are outliers that don't fit in that million part, we just kind of like shove them aside and ignore them, be like, I'm going to just ignore that because it doesn't fit inside of my graph.
True. Yeah.
And so I love all the conversations that are happening right now about those outliers. And, you know, what I think one of the beautiful things about the internet is that it sort of allowed all the freaks to unite and realize that, wait a second, Andy, you're not the only one. There are lots of other people like you out there who have similar tendencies and who have similar desires to create. And once you find them, how empowering that is to sort of have that, like, oh, I'm not an outsider. I was just in the wrong pool.
Yeah, 100%. And I think it's weird, actually, because I'm so in the mainstream world, I am such an advocate for neurodiversity. I'm such an advocate for, we're not all the same. Quit treating every person like they're the same. Their struggles are different than yours. Their strengths are different than yours. Let's embrace all that stuff. But the funny thing is, when I'm in the creative culture, I almost feel like I'm doing the opposite very often, which is saying, you are not a complete outlier. You have people. You have people you can learn from. Don't quit thinking so far outside the box. Let's just like rethink the way that we approach that, because there's so much power in finding your people. There's so much power in learning from others, cooperating, finding your lane, finding your scene. All that is so important. Most of where that comes from for me is, yeah, community and all the stuff that you get from that. But beyond that, I feel like creativity is not unlike science. Like, I think it's going somewhere. We're pushing, we're progressing. It goes a lot of different places, but I ultimately think in creativity, when you have that attitude of, I am the lone genius, nobody is anything like me, and you lean into that too much, you're basically a scientist out there like trying to invent electricity. And we're like, we did that. Like, you don't, like, come on, like, stand on the shoulders of giants. Like, there are people out there that are like you, doing stuff, making progress, making breakthroughs that can influence you and impact your work. And if you don't see yourself as this disjointed thing outside of everything else, as this singular, there's a direction of that that becomes so ego that it's so funny that sometimes I find like the people that are the craziest about ego and copyright are also the socialist, which, not to get political, but it's just very weird that artists in terms of economy tend to be lean towards, let's share everything, let's be a community. But when it comes to their art, It's like, back off. That's mine. Don't, you know what I'm saying? It's so.
I know exactly. And so this might insult some people out there. I had a conversation about this the other day about like, I'm becoming more and more willing to just say like, it's okay if you don't like what I have to say. It's totally fine. And that's part of what we're talking about. But it's really interesting how there is this tendency among human beings. If it's unchecked, it's natural. And so it's like a conscious thing that we have to think about and do. But what is this thing that the world needs to support me? I'm totally on board with that idea when it serves me. But the second it doesn't, then you're a parasite and like you're copying me and you're my competitor. And, you know, like all this stuff where it's just like, whoa, 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 whoa. Like you stepped on my toe and like, no. And
yes, it's so bizarre to me. So I feel it's very weird that I would be the, you know, neurodiversity guy and kind of mainstream culture, but within my own tribe and culture, I'm almost doing the opposite work. But I feel like a lot of the things that I want to talk about are things that, you know, I think if you're going to be someone who does any thinking for a living, you know, in comedy, they call it clapter, which just means you go up on stage and you say something that everybody in the room, we've already agreed, we agree on it. And so you're like, hey, by the way, I think women should have equal rights. If you say that in a comedy club, everyone's going, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. And it's kind of a negative thing in the comedian's eyes because you're like, that's so easy. What's not easy is to go up there and say, here's a controversial idea, but I want to present it. It's a different kind of way of thinking about a thing. And then I'm going to give you some punchlines and some thinking that might help you see some things from different angles. And so I feel like in the creative space with my podcast, I'm often diving in and swimming into dark waters that are like the babies of creative thought. Like these are the things we've all generally accepted as true. And it's less like me saying, that's not true. But there's this Niels Bohr quote that says the opposite of a profound truth might be another profound truth. And that the domain of truth is non-dual. So it's just, it's not black and white. It's not, if this is true, it doesn't mean that that's false. It means that there's all these different ways of thinking about a thing. So there's a lot of my work on the podcast is about taking things like copyright and originality and thinking outside the box, all those things, and saying, okay, I understand some of the value of those ideas, but there are also other ways of thinking that can be very productive and helpful.
Yes, totally. Like, oh my gosh. So I remember having this conversation. I think back in the early days of my blog, there was a lot of conversation about changing copyright laws and how that would impact artists. And I think there's a couple of things I want to say about this that I think is so interesting. Like at first I was, hell no, I created it. It's mine. I own this. Like that's just, like, you're stealing from me, right? I was absolutely like, this is like, we've got to fight the man or whatever yeah. It is, right? And interestingly, like, I changed my mind a lot about it and became open to, like, what if the best thing, this is going to freak everybody out, but what if, let's just go down this path and play what if the best thing is to allow other people to freely share and distribute your work. Like I feel like I'm kind of in the middle of it, but I think we need to go down these thought processes and we need to check our assumptions and we need to have these conversations. And the idea that really I could not take that idea and it didn't fit with my sort of everything should be copyrighted. And like the second I put that down on paper, it's mine. And that idea was this, like, if you think about, it's easier to think of it in a different industry, but think about music and all the evolution of music and from classical to rock and roll, which was borrowed, stolen, taken from gospel music, was taken from like all these different ideas that allowed music to progress. And then we get into rap and we get into sampling and we get into all that stuff. And that stuff was amazing and revolutionizing. And it was taking the familiar and switching it up and creating something completely new. But you need to be able to borrow from the past culture and respond to it in order to create something new and relevant. And if you think about like not being able to do that ever, not being able to look at what another, like look at and respond to another artist. And the sampling in music was one thing that just like, I couldn't deny that. I can't. And I also couldn't wrap my head around what does that mean for us? And it completely changed my perspective on that. And I think that's something that, you know, as artists, we need to be doing and open to.
I think that's phenomenal. There's one of the things that started opening my mind about all that was, did you ever see the web series, Everything is a Remix by Kirby Ferguson? It's four-part series, little web series. They're kind of small videos. It's amazing work on that topic. And he goes into, you know, how Star Wars is basically just a samurai movie plus space, and how George Lucas even literally ripped off like all of these shots from samurai movies and just all these different things. They talk about Led Zeppelin and the Beatles, you know, the Beatles were a cover band, and even just all this stuff. He makes it a very compelling argument. And I think that for me, the question, I'm very inspired by philosophy. I didn't go to an American school, so I didn't go to philosophy when I was in college. I just kind of got obsessed after school listening to podcasts and all that kind of stuff. But I'm very inspired by the idea of how philosophies kind of rip apart an idea, and they keep digging into the next question, getting to the bottom of what are we really talking about here? And I think in the world of copyright, I've thought so intensely about it that I've come to this idea of, why do we want copyright? And by the way, I'm not anti-copyright because it's non-dual to me. So there's on both sides, like I think copying and creativity, copying can be incredible in terms of the sampling thing. Like there's lots of good examples. Can also be horrifying and horrible. And it's not about, is it this or that? But I do think it's good to have a philosophy around it.
Yeah. When you walk into Target and you see your design printed on hundreds of thousands. Yeah. Horrifying. To me, that's different.
Very different.
The intention.
Yeah. The circumstance. Like, and here's where ultimately I come down to this is when it comes to the flourishing and the progression of creativity, I am very pro sharing. I'm very pro. When it's about, when the artists are about pushing creative work forward. And for me also, I think you get to the bottom of, I think we have a misunderstanding in culture of what is creativity? What's the purpose of creativity? I think if you ask somebody who's not an artist or not a creative who hasn't thought much about the question, if I said, what's creativity mean? I think the first words they would go for are original, that new and original.
Innovative.
And I think, innovative. Yeah, that's synonymous to creativity. And to me, when I think about creativity, I think about art. And when I think about art, I think about meaning making, like making meaning out of life. Like that's what art is about to me. And so for me, then you say, okay, then what's the role of originality? If art isn't about originality, it's about making meaning or making sense of life or making life worth living, enriching life. If it's those things, then why do we need originality? And I think there's kind of two reasons in our current state of the economy and the world that we live in. There's two reasons why we need originality. One is a pure reason to me, which is in the same way the word gets worn out when you say it too much, meaning, story, like the hero's journey is as a story. We've told that story a bajillion times as a culture, as a species, back to the oldest times. And the reason it's so important is, I mean, I could go again, I'm approaching this like some layman's creative philosopher who I have all these different things. I could just keep traveling back to a deeper, deeper question here. But we have the hero's journey is basically, as far as I can tell, and as far as lots of people can tell, it's kind of the narrative of how our brain works. So that story helps us make sense of life. And so we've told that story a million times, but after you've watched The Matrix 50 times, which is the hero's journey, all of a sudden it doesn't help you make sense of life anymore. You need Harry Potter, which is the same story, but fresher. It's got an original side to it compared to The Matrix. And so for me, the value of originality is just keeping it fresh. It's like why we need new words for the same thing so that we can feel it again. You know what I mean? But the other side of originality that I think is useful in our current culture is, and this is where I think most people are, you know, falling, is that we need it because we live in a capitalist society. Now, again, I'm not making any claims on whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think it's a very complicated question. But the fact of the matter is, in order to get paid, we got to know whose it is. We need to know who gets the credit for this thing. And so to me, it's not whether that's a good or bad thing, but it is a less pure thing if your goal is creative flourishing and not economic goals. So anyway, obviously you can tell I'm very obsessed with this conversation.
This episode of the Savvy Painter podcast is sponsored by Picture Salon. Picture Salon is a small family-run business that has been making high-quality prints for over 15 years. Picture Salon also offers drop shipping. That means they will print your work and ship it directly to your collector in a package that looks like it came from you. They will even include your branding, your business cards, your stickers, et cetera, et cetera. The fact that they'll do drop shipping for you saves you a lot of time and hassle, especially if you live outside of the US, but you have collectors in North America. Your prints don't have to cross an entire ocean to get to their new home. If you're curious about offering limited edition prints, print on demand, or greeting cards, but you don't really know where to start, I have something special coming up on the Savvy Painter podcast just for you. Jake Holly from Picture Salon will be here to answer all of your questions about getting your work ready for print. You can ask about giclées. Why do they even call them giclées? What's that about? All the different print substrates like fine art papers. Are they archival, photo or poster paper, printing on canvas, acrylic or metal? All of that stuff. You submit the questions and I will make sure you get your answers. Jake and his crew know the ins and outs of getting accurate images of fine art and how important the nuances are. You want to pick their brains? Now's your chance to ask them anything. Jake and his crew over at Picture Salon pride themselves on giving personal attention to the artists that they work with. They are experts in translating that technical gibberish into plain language so that you can get the best quality prints and images of your work. So I know you guys have a lot of questions for them. I posted something on Instagram a while back and you guys blew up the comments there. So I brought Jake and his crew on to get you all of those answers. I want to know what your questions are. Anything you want to ask, they are here to answer. So you have until Monday, October 21st, 2019 to ask Jake and his team anything that you want about giclées, getting your work ready for print, drop shipping, or any of that technical gibberish that makes your head spin. So go to savvypainter.com/picturesalon before Monday, October 21st, 2019 to submit your questions. And then on October 31st, you're going to get all of the answers. So once again, that's savvypainter.com/picturesalon, and you have until October 21st, 2019. I can't wait to learn from your questions. This is so interesting to me because I think, like, to me, what gets lost in the whole copyright discussion is the intention of it.
100%.
Which was to prevent large corporations from stealing somebody, you know, like what happens. I hate to like harp on Target, but they seem to have done it often enough that they have a reputation for it of taking artists' work and presenting it as their own, a complete ripoff and making tons of money off of it. That is the thing that we were trying to prevent. So it's, to me, it's kind of like putting locks on the door of your house. Like you're trying to prevent, you know, like make it more difficult from somebody to just wander in your house and steal your stuff. But that doesn't mean that you are going to shutter down the windows and live your life like locked inside of a safe because, you know, something bad might happen. And I think that's the thing that gets lost in all that, this whole conversation. And that's like one thing that I was thinking about when you were talking about this. But the other thing is just like this whole, like this idea of sharing. It's interesting. So you and I might say sharing it and other people might say, no, it's being stolen. So the language is super, super important. But if you think about it this way, like you and I both could have chosen to keep everything we know to myself. I could easily have just said, nope, all the other artists out there, they're my competition. In fact, you, Andy, why am I talking to you? You have another podcast. This is obscene. What have I lost my mind by inviting you on my show?
That's right. That's hilarious. Yes.
But we're not duplicates of each other. You're going to tell your hero's story one way and I'm going to tell it my way. And people are going to listen to us both, or some people might hate me and love you or vice versa. And that's great. Like that's exactly what we're talking about is the more we share, think about like for those of you listening who might be kind of like the hairs on the back of your neck might be standing up because of this conversation about copyright. Like, you're benefiting from us being free with our ideas and not hoarding them.
100%. And I think even further than that, there's two things that spring to mind that are things that have led me to have more of an abundance mindset and a more sharing mindset, as two different ideas that really helped me around that. One was, I heard a comedian talking about, like, they've learned that when one comedian breaks through the kind of confines of the comedy world into the mainstream, that it tends to have a ripple effect when comedy goes in and out of the mainstream. So stand up. And sometimes there's a big figure in stand up that's really having a big impact on the mainstream. What ends up happening, that ripples into comedy becomes popular. All of a sudden now comedians are getting specials and all that kind of stuff. So they've found that when someone's taking off, instead of trying to rip them down, they're increasing comedy in the culture, and it's good for all these comics. And that idea is that rising tide raises all ships. But there's also this idea of, like, if a McDonald's sets up, this is a weird example, I guess, but if a McDonald's sets up in the middle of nowhere, their sales will be much worse than if a Burger King sets up. So if there's two restaurants, this is like a fact. This is like a vibe. There's restaurants here. And there's plenty of ideas around that idea, but yes.
This would be taking the idea to an extreme, but what you're saying is, like, a single McDonald's starts in the middle of the desert and there's nothing around it, it's going to do terrible. But if a Burger King opens up next door, they're both going to do better.
Yes. And then just beyond that, I think there's long game. For me, I'm always thinking through that lens of, I'm not in this to make a quick buck. I'm not in it to become an overnight success in terms of fame or whatever. I'm much more interested in having this relationship with the people that love the type of creative work that I make forever. And there's something about, I think about this idea a lot of, your conscious mind is the hero in your story, and your subconscious mind is like the audience watching you. So, like, one of the things that ends up happening is,
I was thinking the subconscious was was Yoda.
Well, I think there is some of that, because what ends up happening is, for me, is like, if the hero, if the conscious mind goes out and wants things that are impure, that the subconscious, as the audience, it's just like when you're watching a movie and the hero wants something that you can tell it's not good for them, it's not really good for anybody, you're rooting against them. You're like, I hope they don't get it, because it's bad for everybody if they get it. And so your subconscious, I think, fights against you going out there and being selfish. So, like, when your goal is, I want to be famous, I want to have a million Instagram followers, all this stuff, and it doesn't benefit anybody else, your subconscious isn't in on it. They're like, because your subconscious has that collective conscious, has this deeper understanding of that we're communal social animals. And it's just like, I'm not helping you with that. And the fact of the matter is, your subconscious
you're on your own, buddy.
Incredibly powerful, right? And so for me, there's a thing of, it's not just about that, yeah, it's good for the bottom line of, or it's, you know, ultimately pays off for me. It's more like, if my whole brain and whole self is going to be in on this journey, there has to be a purity to it. I had a friend, does a lot of work with people named Condé Bartlett. And this really helped me recently. I was going through this process of, I had this opportunity that was kind of a lot bigger than anything I'd ever done. And it was also going to require a bunch of new energy and all this stuff. And I was kind of going through this process. I could tell the ego part of my brain was like, yes, this is going to be amazing. But I could tell the rest of me was like, is this going to, like, be good for anybody else? Like, and she did this thing of saying, take your goal and then write about how this will positively impact your spouse, how it'll positively impact your kids, how it'll impact your podcast listeners, how it'll impact all of these people. And as I did it, I could just feel the intensity of my ambition just rise in this, like, I've got to go do this. So I think that there's this thing of long game, and then a long game in terms of people, the way people see you. They can smell whether you give a shit about them. Do you care? And I think for me, that's something I always, with the podcast, that's why I got into it. But it's tough when you're recording, because a lot of my episodes are monologues. The majority of them are, you know, I'm doing my illustration throughout the week. I'm planning the podcast. I go record it, and I'm not seeing any podcast listener for weeks at a time, unless I go do talks. That empathy, I have to figure out, how do I ignite it? Because if this show starts being about me and my ego and how cool I am or whatever, it's going to go down the drain real quick. And long game, I'm just going to start bleeding listenership and I'm not going to help anybody anyway, which is the freaking reason I did it.
So this is this. I want to like kind of like I want to.
I know.
I'm laughing right now because I have this hand gesture that nobody else can see.
Is that a jar?
And some of my friends have called it. Yeah, it's I'm twisting a big giant jewel in my hand and there's lots of facets on it. So this is the same thing, but we're going to look at it from a different angle and get the reflection in and a different rainbow to come out.
You can't watch this, but she's twisting her hand like there's an enormous gem in it. And yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. If you knew what goes on inside of my head, wow.
This is good company for me. Believe me, I've got plenty of weirdness. I realized at the start of this, I'm like, I'm looking at you. I'm so intensely listening that my hands are over my mouth. And I'm like, Andy, that's a weird gesture. Stop. What are you doing?
Oh my God, that's so funny. I thought when you did that, you were trying not to breathe into the microphone, which I'm like, oh, I should do that.
Totally. Like, that's weird behavior.
Okay, the jewel. Let's get back to this jewel.
Doing some weird hand things. Yeah.
I'm doing the weird hand thing, the jewel thing, which is apparently an antresism. I'm really curious about that concept of how you made that decision to do or not to do this opportunity that you had. Can we talk about that in terms of an artist in their studio? I hear this a lot. Like, I get an opportunity and, oh my God, should I do this or should I not do this? Like, I've got this show possibly, but it's not exactly what I do, but maybe I should do it. And then there's this like, oh my God, how do I make this decision? So can we twist that little jewel and talk about it in terms of an artist sitting in their studio? How do you make decisions about what's good for your career?
That is a phenomenal question. It's a huge question. It's something, obviously, I think a lot about. I know a lot of my listeners struggle with that. You know, one of the things that happens in my show is, like, most of the time, creative people at least start in a place where they need to get the flow happening. They need to, like nothing, they're not struggling with which opportunities they should choose. They're struggling with the fact they don't have any opportunities, right? Like, that's the early days. Everyone starts there. And so most of my show is about making waves. So it's about like making things happen for yourself. And I think what I realized a few years in is I would be convincing them so hard on that, that when something cool would come their way, they would feel like they need to turn it down because they're focused on doing their thing, right? And they would be like, "That what would Andy do? He would just keep doing his, he's like single-minded on that goal because I'm really hardcore about that kind of stuff." But then I, through conversations, realized that that's not how I feel at all. To me, there's this kind of ebb and flow of making waves when nothing's happening and then going with the flow when the river comes to you. When a wave just shows up, you got to ride it. And I think that now there's a bunch of nuance to all that stuff. But for me recently, this opportunity that came my way, it was a thing that I didn't see coming. It was not on my horizon. Didn't think I would ever do anything like that. And so now, if it was a yes or no question, I would have just said yes, just to see what the hell is going on. Like, I just said, check out what this is. But ultimately, in terms of my drive and my clarity, which is a huge deal for me, one of the things that really, really helps me is going back to the hero's journey. So, and I'm going to explain that real quick, but just to give a little groundwork, you know, the hero's journey for me, if you don't know, I'm sure they're all familiar with Joseph Campbell and all that work. But to me, mythology.
If not, you guys need to go find it and listen to it. It's on YouTube.
Huge. And there's so much good work around it. Christopher Vogler did a version called The Writer's Journey. He kind of distilled it a little bit more simply for screenwriting. You should check Dan Harmon, who's the creator of Rick and Morty and Community. He turned it into and I'm just giving you all the stuff, the juicy stuff that I love. I love collecting these cool little things. So yeah, I'm just sharing them. Dan Harmon has his writing circle where he took Christopher Vogler's 12 phases, you know, boiled them down to 9. But anyway, I ran into a handful of books, including Hero of 1,000 Faces with Joseph Campbell, that really starts talking about the power of myth. And I think even if I say that, I feel like unless you go into the work, you don't really know what he means by that. Because we just think we're talking about religion, myths, things that cultures of all time.
Greek mythology, Zeus.
Yeah, all that stuff. When really he's saying, when in his work of comparative mythology, he found there is a story structure. And the story structure I think it seems like a formula that we made so that we could be good at entertaining each other, when in fact, I think that there's the science to say that one of the things, I know I'm going way crazy. If you just hold this thread, we're going to get to the answer to that question. But
can I add one thing to it that you're exactly right. It was designed to entertain each other, because back when it was originally, let's just call it like innovated, like I would imagine that there was some trial and error. But back then we were dependent on storytelling because we had no writing. We had no books. Our books were so expensive. So you had to be able to tell a good story in order for the message to carry on. And that's one of the, oh God, so down the rabbit hole. But that's one of the most horrific things about the languages in the world that are disappearing, because the stories are disappearing too. And that is the horrific thing when people are displaced from where they were from, because they use landmarks in their stories as part of the hero's journey. And when those landmarks are no longer there or lose the significance, the story dies. But circling back, like, I think that the science came after.
Yeah, it did. And I think there's this oral history, there's all this ways of connection and entertainment and all that. And I think that that is this huge part of this. But I find, to me, what like changed my life, really changed my life, it's why one of the few things, top five things, is this notion of scientists talk about, there's this idea of emergence, which is like a lot of disparate things coming together to become a bigger thing. So like subatomic particles come together to become an atom. They come to little things, somehow emerge into a bigger thing. Their relationship to each other is such that they're one thing now. So then all these atoms come together, now they're a molecule. The molecule is not a bunch of atoms, it's a thing. And the molecules come together to become cells, and cells, tissue, organs, all these things, and then neurons. In your brain, they can't point to what is your sense of self, which we all have, which is, I'm one thing. Andy isn't a body, a bag of organs. I'm a thing. I'm my own thing. Just like a molecule is its own distinct thing apart from or above all these anything. I'm going to get back to story. Anyway, their point is, the thing they point to of what is us is the story that the neurons are telling each other. And that's consciousness. And so you see your experience through the lens. The way you understand being a person is through the lens of story. And it's my theory, I don't know if anybody else has said this, is story is that framework within our minds. So it's like, it's not so much a thing that we made up as it is a thing that is already present. And that's why it resonates with us, because we're like, that's how I see myself. Does that make sense?
So people who aren't really into abstract thinking have already turned us off, I think. They've already went, and everybody else is on the edge of their seat, like I am right now, like literally trying not to lean too close into this, like, Andy, the idea of the story, like how we view our lives, is a story that we tell ourselves. It's inside of our head. Like, it's the thoughts that we have. So that's kind of how I think about it. You think of it as story. I think of it as the thoughts that I create in my head are optional.
Totally. Yes.
I get to choose.
100%.
I get to choose. And I do have defaults that are negative. And if I can catch those, I can tell myself a different story, which is equally true, which is that I'm turning the jewel again.
Yes. And I think even the story that you, the thoughts you're describing, it's the same as the story of that you're telling yourself of, which archetype are you in the story? If you don't see yourself as the hero, you'll see yourself as the trickster. You'll see yourself as the villain or whatever it is. And so, you know, to me, they're entertaining each other, and they're also making, when they sit down around the fire, as they've hit hardship and obstacle and they feel bad about themselves and all that crap, by the time the storyteller tells the story, they go to bed with a sense of peace, because they're like, I get what obstacles are about. I get why I need to triumph over this thing. And so for me, all the way back to this question on how I decide to say yes or no, is that I always try to get a sense of, see, I pulled it back. There's a method to all this insanity, but I try to always have a sense of the hero's journey that I'm on right now. And I've done that through literally, there's books out there that'll help you do this, but tapping into what phase do I feel the pulse of? And almost like seasons. You know, I've heard Austin Kleon and what's his name? Todd Henry, and lots of great people do work on seasons. I did an episode about seasons, but it's this idea of like, if you have a sense of the story, the narrative that's trying to happen in your life, you will not be trying to harvesting when you should be planting. And I think so for me, this opportunity, I had to reframe. I was put the first 6 months of this year kind of in a very cloudy zone until I realized I saw the thread of the connection of this is how it relates to the story that I'm currently in. This is how, and if I can't find that, it's just totally disparate. I feel like it's a distraction and I'll usually walk away from it. Unless it's just so big and unusual that a new story, and that's the only other thing. This is where I'm going to get to it. So the other thing is the way that a new thing will roll up, and I will say yes to it, even though it was unexpected, is when a new story is being birthed and I can feel a call to adventure. This is a new call. And those are seasons too. There's a season where this thing's winding down. I've been doing this thing for X amount of years, that thing. And it might be, you know, it might be on autopilot for a while or put it in the crock pot or whatever you want to say. But at some point, there's always another call to adventure. And it's always going to be something you didn't expect. And if you can sense with your intuition and your contemplation over it, that pulse of life, like this is where it's going next. This is where the narrative. And again, I think, I don't know whether that's a thing where you're saying, you know, there's like an intuitive or a divine leading or something. It depends how your persuasion is on that. But it can also just be, is my whole self at the edge of their seat with this call to adventure? Is my conscious mind and my subconscious mind like, we're in. We want to see what's around that bend. Then that's a call. And I think I try to distinguish those. That idea of really trying to understand my life through the lens of story is definitely the thing that's had the biggest impact on me.
Yeah. And I love the idea that these opportunities that we are sometimes presented with are calls to adventure. And this idea of seasons, I think it's really important to kind of elaborate on, because you alluded to this earlier, that at a certain point in your career, the opportunities aren't coming. And I think that at that point, that is kind of the season where you are kind of saying yes to everything, because you're discovering who you are, you're discovering how you work, you're discovering who you like to work with. There's all this, these things that you need to discover. So that is this, you know, like I'm making this up right now on the fly, but I think that is the season of saying yes to everything.
Yes, 100%.
And then there comes another season. So maybe that's spring, and then you have the summer to like execute on that or whatever. And then there's another season where you really need to buckle down and protect your time massively. And that is the season where you need to be saying no, where the word no is crucial, and saying no to opportunities, even if it hurts you right now, saying no for now.
Well, the big part of that for me, just to put it into practical terms for how that plays out, is partially probably because of ADHD. It's also just a creative person and just loving new. One of the things that I think is very tempting to me is that once it's time for harvest, once it's time for let's reap the benefits, let's put in the time and energy to take this thing, let's finish the marathon strong, that's when I find it so difficult to say no to other things. And I've leave so much great stuff on the table because I think that creativity, I can kind of see how this is going to play out. So it's a little bit boring to me. It's like, if I keep going down that road, I'll sell more work, all this stuff. And I'll instantly be like, yep, so that story's done, but it's not over yet. Like I barely, you know what I mean? I haven't scratched the surface. And so that's where saying yes becomes a temptation instead of an opportunity. I'll give an example of that. So early in my career, one of the first things I ever did was a thing called the Indie Rock Coloring Book. And this was published by Chronicle Books, and it was on TV and, you know, on all the gift guides, USA Today and all that crap. It was such an unusual thing to do an adult coloring book that, like I said, it was like on E's That Morning Show, like on cable TV. They're doing like a segment about this coloring book. And I did that book and I was just instantly like, all right, like what's next? I got to, go do something else. And my wife was like, this is 2009. And my wife was like, I think there's something to this like adult coloring book thing. I was like, no, nobody cares about coloring books. It's just, you know, it was just kind of a cool thing. And like 4 years later, Amazon best-selling, huge like things. And that I didn't reap anything financially from it because I did that indie rock coloring book for charity. And it did a few cool things in my career. But there was that thing of like I wanting to move on so fast. And I actually did have some opportunities come my way from that I was like, yeah, I'm not interested in that. I'm moving on to the next thing.
Do you think that sometimes there's a little bit of self-sabotage that happens in there?
100%. I'm very prone to self-sabotage. Like I will tell you this, I got to this place where for a long time, my illustration style, I was in the world of advertising illustration. It was great. But one of the problems was that I hadn't figured out how to translate my style really well into vector stuff. So if you don't know what that is, people are not doing that kind of thing. Just from Photoshop to Illustrator. In Illustrator, you can scale the pictures infinitely.
Infinitely. Yeah, because it's mathematical.
It's mathematical. And so I couldn't figure out how to do my style in Illustrator. And it took me forever. And I eventually, as soon as I got it to click, and I was like, whoa, this is awesome. This is a style that would work really well for the brands I want to work with. I did like two jobs from that. And then I instantly, subconsciously, I noticed myself starting back. I don't really want to do that anymore. Like, just like right when this thing I've been working for years and I figured it out. And there's something about like doing the actual projects that would come in. I would enjoy doing them. It was literally like, just self-sabotage, just this thing I've worked so hard for, and I almost get to the finish line, and I just instantly run a different direction.
Yeah, you just sit down, you're 2 feet from crossing the finish line, you just sit down, you're like, I'm good here.
Yep, and so I see myself doing all that time. That's another thing I highly recommend is like pattern recognition. I think about how wisdom is just basically pattern recognition. It's in knowing, what are your patterns? What are the things that, and it's good, you know, if you're in community and relationship with other creative people, like I highly recommend, even though I'm quite disgusted by the term mastermind, that's one of the reasons why it took me so long to have one. I'm not going to be in a mastermind. If you're not familiar, it's a business thing where a few people.
I love masterminds.
I love them.
But I've had insanely like good experiences with them. Like I've been in one for years that we're best friends. I mean, we know everything about each other.
It's probably the single most powerful tactic in my creative arsenal. And I've only been doing it this year. I literally put it off for years because of bad, limited thinking of whatever it is. I don't like the brand of that thing or whatever that is. But getting in that community is so essential because it gives you this outside perspective that elevates your self-awareness. So you start recognizing your patterns. It's like every time you're at this season, every time you're in the planting season, Andy, you go self-sabotage, or you're in the harvest season, like, and they'll notice it. They're like, oh, I'm feeling self-conscious about this thing. And they're like, oh, let me guess what it is. That thing. Because at this stage of the project, you always do this. And so I started working with coaches too.
Oh my gosh, I've had those conversations.
Yes, because it's so hard to recognize your own patterns, but the wisdom and the growth is all there.
It's hard to recognize them. And then even when you do, if you don't have anybody to be accountable to, it is so easy to dismiss them and not deal with it. It is so easy to sweep your own crap under the rug.
100%. And I can feel myself. I started working with a book coach, because I've been trying to write this book for literally years. And I worked with him for several weeks. And then I had a break. And in that break, I'm reverting to all of my same behaviors that stopped me from doing the book. There is this weird thing of having this accountability, having that community around you to help you, call you on your crap. But you have crap, whether you like it or not. I don't care how healthy you feel. I feel very healthy. I've never been healthier in so many ways. But I still fall into these weird little ruts that are well-worn, and it can happen to me very easily if I don't have people around me.
Oh my gosh, yeah. It's incredible. Like when you're working, and the thing is like you can be working with somebody who's like, let's call it your Yoda, your guide, since we're on that this is the episode for the power of myth.
I'm always on that.
Yeah. And so you think like, okay, I'm a Jedi now. I'm staying with Star Wars. I'm a Jedi now. right? I don't need Yoda anymore. Within 24 hours, you're back at wherever. Like, it is crazy how quickly you will do that, or at least I will do that. I've watched it happen. I've watched myself do that so many times. So yeah, you definitely need that other eye on you, let's say, or that guide to help you. And to, I don't know how you feel about it, but I get a little, maybe I'm a little bit arrogant about it, or that I get a little like disappointed in myself that, like, oh, for God's sakes, you know what to do. You know, you have the knowledge. Why do you need Yoda to point out to you, or to just be there?
It drives me nuts, actually, because I think the things that he's telling me, I tell other people all the time. Like, it's not that I don't know them. There's just something about that relationship. Yeah, I don't know if it's accountability or what. I'll tell you this. One thing that one question that's been really powerful for helping me unearth a lot of that unhealthy behavior, and it comes from, I always cite my sources, but sometimes my sources aren't things that I'm co-signing. So I'm not co-signing this individual, but this question really has been brilliant to me. I heard it from Tony Robbins. He was on a podcast I listened to. No offense to Tony Robbins people. I just don't happen to be a Tony Robbins person. Like, I've never drank that Kool-Aid or whatever, but whatever, if you do, fine. I love you anyway. But I heard him on a show, and he said this question, and it's basically haunted me for the past couple of years. And I think it's helped me to unearth a ton of why I have these particular triggers that get these bad behaviors. And he said that, you know, which of your parents did you have to earn their affection, and who did you have to be to get it? And I think for me,
what mask did you have to put on?
Yeah. And so for me, a lot of my, cause you know, so much of your crap develops when you're a kid. I think for the first 18 years of my life, I was trying to get my mom's affection and to be great in her eyes, to get praise from her. I think I had to be cool or famous or popular or original. So like, be a one of a kind, like, how unique, how weird, how interesting,
How
creative you are. Yes. And so I think at then 18, I think I switched over to my dad, and my dad, I think to really impress him, you have to achieve in a world-class way like that. There's only two people that I ever saw impress my dad. He's not easily impressed. Michael Jordan and Peyton Manning. That's it. Like, number one in the world throughout history at their thing. And so this like level of achievement, and I think I spent a decade kind of in that zone. And I think, so for me, I notice, like, if I'm feeling like someone's calling me on originality or my creativity, like my identity is threatened. And so that'll, all this nasty stuff will come up. Or if I feel like I haven't achieved, or my achievements are in question, it'll trigger this weird behavior.
Well, we all have these buttons that can be pushed, right? Some of us do a really good job of disguising those buttons and hiding them. So we, again, think, like, from the outside, it looks like, oh, that person does not have those buttons. But we're all human, not to oversimplify it, but it is really that simple. We are all human beings, and we all have our and that's why, like, I talk about this a lot, but comparing yourself to other artists, and I'll call it the dark side of social media, which is the myth that people's lives really are as fantastic as what they're showing there. And I do not for one second believe that there are some people who do, but I think the majority of people aren't thinking, I'm going to create a facade on my Facebook, or pick your social media. I'm going to create this facade and present this. It's just a natural tendency to show, like, the great stuff and not want to talk about the stuff that's crap. The 50% that, and I think it really is like 50% of our lives are just fabulous if you let it. And then there's 50% that's crap.
Totally.
It's not fun, and it sucks, and we have to do things that we don't like to do and all of that stuff. But that's why we get the other 50% that is just beautiful.
Yes. And I'll tell you two things on that idea on comparing yourself that has helped me. One is really fast and simple. It's just this idea. I've been more into jogging again recently. And one of the things that I will notice, my competitive spirit flare up when I'm out on the bike trail and someone just passes me, and I notice myself be like, I've got to speed up. And then I'm realizing, like, you're not in a race. You don't know. They might have just started. and they're starting with a sprint. They might be finishing. They might only be doing a 5-minute run. What your run is totally different than their run. And I think it's like racing in art is not unlike going out there in the park and being like, all right, I'm going to win this thing today. Like nobody's racing. Everybody's starting in different places, like very, very different. And then the other thing that happened to me recently that got me thinking deep about this is we were redoing my house and I had to move my fridge. And my handyman, a bunch of other people kind of made it seem like if you have the right like dolly, you should be able to move a fridge pretty easy. It's not that big a deal, actually. If you get the right one, you can strap it down and all that. So I got one and I strapped it in. And as soon as I started moving, I was like, this doesn't feel right. This is like insanely heavy and it feels dangerous. Like I feel like I might hurt myself. But because everyone acted like I should be fine, I just thought, I'll just do it. I took it down the stairs and whatever. And luckily I got it into my neighbor's garage. We were storing it, but like it felt scary. I felt like I could have hurt myself doing that by myself. But because everyone made me feel like I should be fine, I just did it anyway. Now, the next week when they were moving it back, because it was so heavy, I finally had the wisdom to be like, hey, can you help me move that? Can your people move it? Because it was pretty intense. And I felt embarrassed admitting that something I should have been able to do by myself because lots of people can do it. I felt embarrassed asking for help. But when he started moving it, he was like, oh no. He's like, I don't know why, but I've moved thousands of fridges. This is by far the heaviest fridge I've ever moved. And you shouldn't have moved it. And I think for me, it made me realize that when we're going out through life and we're comparing ourselves to other people, it's so easy to feel like, well, I should be able to do this. I should be fine. I shouldn't need help. I shouldn't need to ask for anybody's assistance. And I did an illustration on Instagram about this like comic of you don't know what's in other people's fridges. Your fridge might be the heaviest fridge that's ever been lifted. And I drew in them like one fridge has like trust fund gold. Another fridge has like childhood trauma. Your fridge has all unique things in it to you. And some people's fridge is really light and you don't know it. And so comparing your fridge to theirs is just ludicrous. And so if you're struggling, if this is hard for you, if it's not working, you can't just because you feel like it should be fine or it looks like everybody else is, I encourage people to go reach out even if you feel silly asking for help. But that comparison trap is a deadly one when we're not all starting from the same starting blocks.
Yeah. And some people have higher things to leap over.
Yes. 100%. Some people have heavier
hurdles. Hurdles. That's the word I was looking for. Hurdles. That thing that you jump over and track that I used to love doing.
When I was a kid and I watched my cousin, I had weird anxiety things when I was a kid. I watched my cousin run track and do hurdles. And I remember having like an existential panic attack as like a 7-year-old being like, you have to do that when you're high school? There's no way I can jump over those.
I'm going to die when I get to high school.
No, I can't do it. It's not going to work. That's my hurdle story. It's not relevant whatsoever. It's as relevant as Roger Rabbit, but I went there anyway. So there you go.
There you go. We all have our hurdle story. I used to love writing hurdles. Once I realized how you do it, there's a very specific way that you do it. And once I realized that, I'm like, this is the most fun thing ever.
Oh, man. I wish I would have known that.
I'll teach you someday.
All right. Go run hurdles. It's a weird activity for two artists to do. You want to go? Let's go run some hurdles.
Let's go down to the track and do some sprints. We'll do the 100-meter hurdle. It'll be awesome. Andy, this has been like, as I knew it would be, so fun talking to you. That's why I knew I had to get you back on the show. I've got 2 minutes now before I need to let you go. Parting thoughts for the artists who are listening. What advice do you have?
My advice is going to be a weird one. It's going to come from left field, but it's one of the things that I get people thinking about all the time, which is I think your true gift is less about your abilities and it's more about your sensibility. It's your sensitivity. It's not so much about what you're naturally better at doing, but I think it's more about what your deeper receptors are. Your ability to produce great things that impact people is led by your intuition. So it's into knowing, like if I, and I'll just give you a quick example. And I just, this is a, like I told you, totally random, but this is a theory that has so helped me. It's helped tons of people that I work with. This idea that quit thinking about talent as like your ability to do some freakish thing and think about talent as your taste, your receptor of how deeply sensitive are you to it? Because at the tip of somebody's tongue, our tongues are wildly different. So some people at the tip of their tongue have like a few taste buds. Other people have thousands. Now, if you're going to be a chef, you need that kind of tongue. You need that receptor that will give you the intuition of, I think I need to add more salt. I think I need to add more whatever. You got to find, what are your receptors? Do you have an ear for music, an eye for pictures? Do you have a funny bone for a sense of humor? Like, that's where I think you got to start is, what lights you up? What scratches your own itch? How do you not make a t-shirt that you want to, you feel like making, but the one that you feel like wearing? So like, what's the art that you want to see out there in the world? You've got to use that internal receptor, that sensitivity, that intuition. Start from that visceral place. And I'll give you one more tip on that is this. For me, this changed my whole creative career when I quit just trying to do cool stuff and what people were wanting and tap into my visceral taste. And what I did was I said, if I was going to get a tattoo right now, I should get something that I think is amazing that my 6-year-old self would also think was amazing. Because if I do that, my 90-year-old self will probably think it's badass. And so there's, if you can get into that visceral sensitivity, that visceral taste, and you can make stuff that really lights you up, it will light up other people too. It's like I said, left field, but thinking about your gift in those terms has been a big breakthrough for me.
I don't think that was left field at all. I loved it. Andy, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. I loved every second of it. I love going down rabbit holes with you. It's so much fun. And I really appreciate you and everything you do.
Thank you so much. Thank you for everything you're doing for creative people. It was a freaking blast. I'm often on like business podcast and like marketing podcast. So it was an absolute treat to just talk Creative Shop with you. Again, thanks for all you do for our people.
Awesome.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Savvy Painter Podcast with Andy Pizza. For show notes of this episode, go to savvypainter.com/podcast. You'll find more information about how to connect with Andy and his podcast, The Creative Pep Talk. And once again, I'd like to thank Picture Salon for help making this episode possible. Remember, if you have any questions about getting your work ready for print, how to photograph it, getting the best color accuracy, Jake from Picture Salon and his team will be here to answer your questions in the next episode of the podcast. I am handing over the mic to you. So head on over to savvypainter.com/picturesalon to submit your questions before October 21st, 2019. It's your chance to ask the questions. That's savvypainter.com/picturesalon or look for the tab in the menu bar at savvypainter.com. I cannot wait to hear what you guys submit. Jake is really excited about answering all of your questions, and I'm really looking forward to getting those answers for you from Jake and his crew over at Picture Salon. So until the next time, this is Antrice Wood with the Savvy Painter Podcast. Thank you so much for listening.